Young men were the only kind who volunteered for a mission like this one. They had a spirit of adventure.
Maro, Duchess! I've heard tell it's 500 years since our people crossed this ocean.
Officially, at least.
There's little frontier left on Darkseid. Even the glacial wastes at the center of the continent are crossed frequently. This will be something new.
Flennet was right. The only records they had of Dayseid were of dubious validity, and most scholars, Chris included, gave them little credibility. Even if they were accurate, 5 centuries was a long time. Traveling to Dayseid was an adventure few experiences could match. Yes, officially, it had been 500 years since anyone had traveled the border ocean. Chris was not a soldier or an explorer. She had never even left the capital, let alone Elis. But she was traveling to Dayseid for one reason, to follow the trail of her late betrothed, who had come here 3 years ago to chase a dream and had died for it.
She's a beauty, isn't she? Look at the smooth action.
Flennet was leaning against the ship's whale, his hand idly cocking and uncocking the flintlock pistol in his hand as he mock-aimed for the land ahead.
You are ordered to keep those hidden, Flennet.
What does it matter? They won't know what it is if they see it.
Put it away, soldier.
Yes, Captain.
He stuffed the pistol back into its place underneath his cloak as Chris drew Bayon off to the side.
I thought I ordered you to leave the guns behind.
You did. I ignored you.
You ignored me?
Duchess, we're traveling to an unknown continent, completely blind as to what we'll find. Did you really expect your soldiers to give up the only advantage we have?
I just thought that... well, that it would be a good idea to keep the technology secret, just in case.
The boy is right about one thing. Assuming they haven't developed gunpowder on their own, then getting hold of one of our pistols will do them little good. They couldn't replicate it. They don't have the technology. They couldn't even make new gunpowder.
That's true, I suppose. Tell me, are you going to ignore all of my orders, Bayon?
No. Only the stupid ones.
Just keep an eye on those three. For some reason, the idea of firearms in Flynn's hands makes me nervous.
On that, we agree.
I doubt we'll even need the guns.
You're optimistic. That's good. You're paying me to be the opposite, however.
Our mission is purely to gather information. To learn as much as we can about Dayseid and the resources there. And then we go home. Who knows? Perhaps the Daysiders will be the ones who end up helping us.
Duchess, if you're intending to find something on Dayseid to help you stop the dynasty, then the legends about this place better not just be true. They better be gross underestimations.
Gevin believed in them.
And look where that got him. Or did you forget that he died?
No. Thank you, Bell. I did not forget.
You shouldn't have put me in charge.
Why do you say that?
Your soldiers don't like me.
They don't have to like you to follow your orders.
That is true. But they resent me as well. Technically, all 3 outrank me. They're noblemen, I'm not. I'm also a foreigner.
You're older than they are. You're more experienced than they are. And you are a better leader. Even after traveling with you for a month, I knew that much.
I'm also a mercenary.
Isn't every soldier, in a way?
Duchess, you have a quick tongue, but despite what politicians and scholars claim, arguing cannot change facts. Those men resent me. You should have let their natural ranks determine who would lead when Captain Dural died.
You're probably right.
She turned away from him, instead focusing on the approaching cliffs. She was not accustomed to being contradicted. She had made a mistake. Of course, it had seemed logical at the time. Bayon's wise bluntness had impressed her from the first time they met months ago when the expedition had begun.
Don't berate yourself. You're young yet. Barely as old as those boys. In fact, I'd guess you're younger. You'll learn.
He was right, though she did not confirm it. She hated it when people realized how young she was.
Young and out of my depth.
Should I go wake the others?
Yes, they'll want to see our approach.
The large man nodded, turning back across the deck to climb down to the lower cabins. Chris was left alone with the three noblemen, whose faces now betrayed none of their earlier looks of resentment. Had she been wrong to assume she could be a leader of men? They were getting closer to land when her two professors appeared on deck, accompanied by Bayon, whose blank expression somehow still spoke volumes about how their constant prattle wore at his patience.
I suppose that thing is going to be there the entire time we're on Dayside.
You mean the sun? It doesn't appear to move, Professor Sinden.
The professor, an older man with barely a few wisps of hair clinging to the top of his otherwise bald head, was Professor Alstrin Sinder, 60 years old with a liver-spotted cranium to prove it. Sinder had been one of her teachers during the years of her university schooling. He had stepped onto the deck, shading his already spectacled eyes.
Well, I suppose I would have been disappointed if there weren't some light to be found over here. The legends do say a great deal about that point, don't they?
By the divine, the adventure finally begins.
The second man was John Akron, anthropologist, a stooped figure of about 5 feet with a sizable paunch that more than made up for his lack of height. 50 years of age, he wore the long mustache over a goatee that was the current style in Elis. Both anthropologist and linguist were dressed formally. They had obviously taken more time getting ready than she had. They wore suits after the fashion of their rank, with vests and matching collar pieces. The long-tailed jackets had wide, drooping sleeves, and Cinder had added a pocket watch and wrist chains, as was his custom. Behind the two stood Bayon, who had donned a functional knee-length jacket to obscure the two pistols at his hips. Seeing the jacket reminded Chris of just how hot she was. She had assumed that perhaps she would get used to it, but so far she'd had no luck. Her clothing, which had seemed so reasonable in her shaded cabin, now felt sweltering.
I have never known such heat.
By the divine, this is a dour place, isn't it?
I think you would be excited, Sinder. After all that studying you've done, now you'd finally get to visit.
I studied the language, not the sun, dear man.
Bayon, when do we dock?
In about an hour. Those cliffs taper a bit to the east, and that's apparently where our town is.
Another hour? In this heat?
Best get used to it, John. The sun's not going away anytime soon.
Professor Sinder pulled out a spyglass from his jacket and peered at the town that lurked on the horizon.
An hour. And it seems we were correct.
Concerning?
Their culture, my lady. I see little evidence of advanced technology.
The professor passed the spyglass to his colleague.
I concur. No sign of... Wait. There is a man carrying a bow, see? They are definitely still in the sword age. Poor fellows.
I can't help thinking you should say poor us.
Why?
From the looks of things, your soldiers seem to have discovered a couple of pistols. However, despite such an obvious advantage, the Elysian military is not known for its martial superiority. I can't help wondering how we'll fare against the natives.
Bayon, is this true?
For a linguist, he has a point.
Thank you, I think.
I've seen you Elysians fight. Your military is more a tool for the pampered to dispose of their offspring than a true defensive army. Your country remains independent through clever politics, superior technology, and the fact that it is so small no one wants to conquer it. Those three will be practically useless against a well-trained squad of natives, pistols or no pistols.
The useless comment didn't gain Bayon any ground with Flennet and the others, who were just within earshot.
Honesty is one thing, Bayon, but there's also something to be said for tact. We're in a foreign land, an ocean away from civilization. If this expedition turns violent, I doubt all the muskets in Elis could save us. The soldiers are more to get us through dynastic blockades than to protect us from Daysiders.
Indeed. Cinder's right, however. The population looks considerably less advanced than what we've come from. The houses are mainly simple clay brick, and the streets look uneven.
And look at the vehicles. Simple carts rather than carriages. And none of the buildings have glass in the windows.
There were other differences besides the level of technology, Chris noticed. Notably absent were the lantern poles that lined every street in her homeland. But, of course, such wouldn't be necessary with the sun's constant light. The great difference by far, however, were the beasts of burden. Up until the point that she looked through Cinder's spyglass, Chris had discounted the stories of strange monsters living in the deserts of Dayside. Now, however, she was forced to reconsider.
Those creatures, do you see? They remind me of the armored war horses that the dynasty sometimes employs.
The beasts were black in color, and the light reflected off their shiny skin. They were proportioned something like a horse, but with shorter legs and a stumpier neck. Their bodies seemed to be composed of plated segments, something like an insect, but they were proportioned nothing like bugs. Most disconcerting were their faces. They were covered with horn-like protrusions that stuck out in random directions. Each creature was different. Some had only a couple, others were covered with dozens, and still others had one massive spike sticking out like an overgrown nose.
Well, they are like no horse I've ever seen.
Perhaps not. And those horns! They must be cosmetic, used to frighten rivals. Many of them look too weak to be used for combat.
Everything must have an explanation, I suppose.
I am a scientist, Cinder. We explain things.
And here I thought you were a duchess.
Oh, last I checked, the two weren't mutually exclusive.
Yes, of course, of course.
You're going to have to find some dresses. Look at the women. They wear dresses and keep their hair tied up under their hoods. Most dark side cultures don't look favorably on women who dress like men, and I suspect it's the same over here. So you should find some dresses.
I have dresses.
Bayan was right, of course. Every woman visible, even the children, had their hair tied up and kept under a hood-like cloth. They wore one-piece dresses. Actually, they fit more like robes, that were loose around the waist, and the styles didn't seem to vary much. The men also wore loose-fitting robes, though they kept theirs tied at the waist, and many wore two layers of clothing. A shirt and a skirt-like item beneath with an open-fronted robe over the top. All of the clothing was much more drab than she was used to, the pervading colors white and tan.
This is going to be so exciting! Educational at the very least.
Well, Cinder, I guess we'll soon find out how much the language has changed over the last 500 years.
Yes.
The only texts they had from Dayside were 5 centuries old. Courses in Daysider language were popular in the university, and Cinder was one of the experts. But underneath all of the postulation and studying was the knowledge that, to Darkside at least, Daysider was a dead language. They really had no clue how to pronounce the words.
You look worried, Professor.
Daunted, perhaps, but thrilled as well. Time to put my learning into practice.
Chris had initially resisted bringing Cinder on the expedition because of his age. However, he was Elissa's premier authority on linguistics. If anyone could speak fluent Daysider, it was him.
Cast the lines and prepare to dock.
The ship pulled to shore, docking against one of a number of tired-looking jetties that ran at the edge of the town.
We're here.
Once they made land, Cinder was keen to test his Daysider on the locals. He, along with Chris, Bayan, Akron, and the soldier called Flenid, made their way to a nearby market, whose colorful stalls ran along the shoreline, beside a street of single-story buildings. Bayan had brought only Flenid, instructing his colleagues to remain on ship for the moment. Cinder turned his attention to a local, asking the name of the settlement and where one might find a civic office. The Daysider looked blankly at his words, frowned, and scuttled away as if in fear.
Sandlord, save me from the rantings of the deranged.
Good effort, Cinder.
No need for sarcasm, Flint.
They are an odd-looking people. Their skin is different, do you see? Not completely white, like those from our eastern countries, but definitely pale.
It looks like there are two races here. Some with skin that's a little pale, kind of a dark tan color. The rest have olive-colored skin.
Yes, two peoples, two cultures, perhaps?
It bears investigation.
So long as you don't scare off any more of the locals with your conversational skills.
Hey, I am...
He's right, Senda. This isn't working.
I don't know what it is, my lady. At first, it seems like they might understand me. Some of them, at least. They always run off, however.
Could it be that they fear us?
It seems unlikely, Bayon. No one's giving us a wide berth. They seem to barely notice us.
Well, it's comforting to know one thing, at least.
Which is?
It would have been tragic if we could actually speak their language. It would have destroyed my reliance on the frivolous nature of higher learning. Some universal constants just have to remain unchallenged.
Now who's being sarcastic? Perhaps it's your accent.
They've reacted the same way to written phrases.
As he spoke, Cinder's gaze was drawn to a stall in the marketplace. Chris followed where he indicated, seeing Akron had wandered away from them to poke through a shopkeeper's wares. He didn't seem to care that they couldn't communicate. The sheer joy of being in another culture was enough for him.
You might want to keep an eye on him.
He's probably overwhelmed. This is the first time he's been out of dynasty-controlled land. As an anthropologist, that must have been frustrating for him.
That man is a fool.
Fool or not, he seems to be having some success in getting that stallholder to understand him. See?
What? How?
Look in the window.
They did so, squinting against the sun's light. Chris could barely make something out. A sign. A sign written in...
Dynastic. Dayside supplies and maps. Shella!
The spelling leaves something to be desired.
Come on!
Chris headed directly for the building, and after a moment, the others trailed her.
I suppose we should.
A shopkeeper, one of the lighter-skinned daysiders who had been speaking enthusiastically with Akron, noticed Chris's approach and smiled eagerly.
Ah, more dockside good friend! You want supplies? Okay, friend?
Oh, how? How does he...
I don't know. He just started talking to me. Amazing, isn't it?
Good dynastic, best friend. Darksider come much. Escape dynasty. Very bad. Much exciting. Need much supplies. Yes, friend.
Perhaps the dynastic blockades aren't as effective as our dear Emperor Skathen would have us believe.
Much Darksiders. I mean... Many Darksiders. How many?
One, maybe. Two ship, 1 week.
Shella, that's unbelievable. Those blockades are supposed to be impervious. The dynasty doesn't even let its subjects travel from one province to another. There's no way they let that many ships escape.
We got through.
True.
And it wasn't very hard.
We lost two men.
What Flendit says is also true. And not just any men. Captain Dural and his lieutenant were well-trained warriors, Bayon.
They weren't killed by the blockade. We lost them sneaking out of Elis and crossing the dynastic lands to reach the ocean. Once we were on the waters, we barely even saw another ship.
Shella, I thought we'd just been lucky. This just got more difficult. Come on. We'll buy supplies later.
She turned to walk away from the shop, and her entourage followed.
Wait! Don't just walking away!
I assume you plan to tell us what suddenly made our lives roam more difficult, Duchess?
Darksider refugees arrive here. That's why no one thinks we look strange. Darksider fugitives are a common sight.
Ah, it is a difficult thing to realize you're not as unique as you thought.
It is a difficult thing to realize no one in this entire town would have taken note of Prince Gelvaldin's arrival 2 years ago. I was counting on the event having been unique enough that people still remembered it. Now we have no idea which way he went.
At least we know this is where he started.
If the ship captain's telling the truth.
He has no reason to lie. Unless, of course, someone paid him to do so. Or he just forgot. Or maybe he wasn't really the one who ferried the prince to Dayside and just said that to get our business. No reason beyond those three, and maybe a couple more.
All right. Back to the ship. I have to think.
The group began to wander back toward the ship. Chris had come to follow Gevin's quest, the one that had killed him. How was she to do that if Gevin was one of dozens, hundreds even, of Darksiders who'd arrived in port over the past 3 years? Their ability to speak the language had proven even less useful than she had assumed. And then there was the eye-opening fact that Darksiders were common on Dayside. But she did have one option. The Sand Mages were supposed to live in a kingdom called Lossan. She would have to make her way in that direction and assume Gevin had done the same. She would have liked to follow his trail exactly, but Chris's thoughts trailed off as something else grabbed her attention. It wasn't in Dynastic, but...
That man speaking. I think I recognize the words. What is that, Cinder?
A short distance away, sitting in an open space beside the market street, was a domed building with broad shadows. People were gathered within, and it seemed like the voice was coming from inside. Not bothering to look to see if the others followed, Chris crossed the small distance to the building and peeked inside.
Wait up, Duchess.
At the front of the room stood an olive-skinned man with a shaven head. He wore nondescript robes with a golden chain around his neck, and in his hand he clutched what appeared to be a long spear with a bone head. Directly in the center of his forehead were a pair of stark white scar marks that formed an X. The man was speaking forcibly to the crowd, his tone familiar for some reason. He stood with his arms outstretched, the spear pointing toward the sky.
Alet Morwen!
The words, pronounced almost so oddly that she missed them, suddenly jumped out at her. She would have missed them completely if they hadn't formed the single most pervasive phrase in the books she'd studied. She wasn't a genius at Daysider, but she had taken some classes.
Takrin, Taubrecht, Delar, Delarna, Karnaisha Totar Kersha, Gredo, Unhara, Karnaisha Totar Kersha, Alet, Morwen, Rekenshana, Karnaisha Totar Kersha.
May the Sand Lord bless us.
I understand it too. Those words, or ones akin to them, end almost half the sentences written in Dayside. One reason the Dayside books were so incredibly thick.
What does it mean?
This? It's a speech of some sort. A religious ceremony, perhaps?
But what is he saying? Can you translate?
I'll ask.
Sid, wait!
Iresha Takasha Aydakasha.
The man at the front looked down at him with a frown of annoyance.
Aisha! Aril Karshan Shan Tershan!
Oh my!
What is it?
I think we should go.
Cinder backed away before the man's anger, leaving the building and its occupants behind.
Do you understand it, Cinder?
A little. The words were spoken so quickly. He called it Karshan. It means...
Holy language.
Why, yes. You're right, Duchess. Gar, meaning priest. Priest language.
You mean...
Instead of Daysider, we learn the exclusive language of the clergy.
There is precedent for such things. I have studied class-specific dialects.
Oh. Well, I guess it's not as bad as it could be.
True. If we can't get directions out of them, then at least we can call them to repentance.
Kenton lay frozen in the darkness.
Six spheres, where there should have only been five.
Kenton! Wake up, you scoundrel!
Is that... Eric?
The moment you declared you were going to run the path, I knew you would surprise us.
Kenton opened his eyes, pushing the damp cloth from his face that had been placed there as he recovered. It was not Eric, his oldest friend, who stood before him, he saw. Eric had gone to Darkseid to find his fortune 2 years ago. Instead, here was his closest friend in the DM of the Sandmasters.
Traben?
Traben stood before him in the healing tent, immaculate as always in his robes and golden sash. He had gone bald early in life and kept what hair he had close-shaven, accentuating his firm, square face.
Whoa there! Don't tell me you're too good to remember me now that you've conquered the path.
As if you'd ever let me forget you, Traben. You've been sifting through my sand since we first joined the Diem as kids.
Hey, if you weren't around, life in the Diem wouldn't be half as exciting.
There was a playful irony to his friend's words. Traben was a Mastral. His high status should have precluded him from associating with a lowly acolyte like Kenton, even one whose father was the Lord Mastral. Yet the two of them had remained firm friends, even after Traben achieved the rank of Mastral, one of seven ranks applied to the Sandmasters, depending on their ability. His body aching, Kenton rose from the bed, its mattress filled with sand.
How long have I been asleep?
A small red-haired boy spoke from where he stood vigil at the doorway of the tent.
About a day?
There was a look of excitement in the boy's eyes. This was Diren, 16 years old, but small for his age, probably because of his Talonar heritage, a racially small people.
When they brought you back, Kenton, all covered in sand and blood, we assumed you were dead. But 6 spheres, Kenton! How did you do it?
I don't know.
Kenton retrieved his guidon and took a long drink from it.
I don't understand where that 6th sphere came from. Were there always 6 possible, and I'm just the first to find the last one?
No, it must have been...
Mastral Traben, be aware of your surroundings.
That was Master Eloran speaking for the first time from where he stood reservedly in a corner of the tent, monitoring Kenton's recovery. As he spoke, he nodded to Diren, who had started to fold the cot's bedsheets and place them meticulously in a pile.
Oh, yes, of course.
Diren, lad. Would you go tell the Lord Mastral that his son has recovered?
Yes, Mastral.
Once Diren had left the room, Florin nodded for Traben to continue.
Now you may go on.
Though there was little chance the boy would ever run the path, it was general policy not to let younger Sandmasters hear the path's secrets.
I found 6.
But Kenton, there aren't supposed to be 6 spheres. The one you found must have gotten left behind following someone else's run.
As you might expect, spheres are often lost where the Sandling is concerned. They get buried deep in the sand, where even the most powerful Mastral wouldn't be able to retrieve them. It is just assumed that they will never turn up again, but...
One must have gotten lodged in the creature's carapace.
For all we know, it could have been my sphere. I only found 3 of them, you know.
You? You never fail at anything, Traben.
I'd ask the other Mastrals about that. My associating with you is considered a fatal character flaw, you know.
I wouldn't say fatal.
Well, perhaps their opinion will change after what you did yesterday running the path.
Kenton reached for a server of sand located in a freestanding urn close to the tent's doorway, running his hands through its contents.
And how is my father taking the news of my success?
As he spoke, Kenton charged the sand.
The Lord Mastral is calling the 6th sphere invalid.
Of course he would.
The small pile of sand flashed, glowing brilliantly, and remained in the air even when he removed his hand. He hadn't overmastered. His abilities, such as they were, still remained.
It doesn't really matter. The entire Diem has already heard about what you did. The Lord Mastral is, of course, rather perturbed with you.
When isn't he?
This time, it's more than usual, Acolend. You weren't supposed to slay the creature. The path is destroyed forever now, Kenton. No one knows how that deep sandling came to be isolated so far away from the deep sands, but it was the central trial of the path. More Mastrals failed to recover that one sphere it was guarding than all the other spheres combined. For centuries, the Mastrals have fed the monster, using it to test their newer members. But now, it is gone.
Good riddance. When that thing burst from the sand, I nearly died from the shock.
Wait a minute. Didn't you have water with you? No one's more prepared than you, Traben. Why did it give you trouble?
It outthought me. Fled beneath the sand as soon as I tossed a handful of water on it. Unfortunately, it took the sphere with it. Its digging probably buried the sphere all the way down to Darkseid. Personally, I don't think it was a very fair test. I did what I was supposed to, and I still didn't get my sphere.
The point is irrelevant now. The path, or at least the path as we know it, is no more.
Kenton flexed his shoulder, feeling the pain of his gash.
Take it slowly, Kenton. You're still recovering.
Yes, Undermastral. But I'm going to have to agree with Traben. I know the path hasn't killed anyone in decades, but we're still probably better off without it.
And you will be remembered as a hero, the acolyte who defeated the path.
Traben patted Kenton on the shoulder.
Hey, easy.
Kenton, perhaps you should stay back and rest today.
What? Ellerin, how could you even suggest such a thing?
Kenton frowned as well. It was an odd suggestion. All Sandmasters, except those left behind to watch the DM, were expected to attend today's ceremony, no matter what their state of health.
I apologize, Mastral. It was a thoughtless suggestion.
I mean, today of all days. After what Kenton did, the Lord Mastral will have to make him a Mastral.
My father doesn't have to do anything. I'll bet he's actually less likely to make me a Mastral after what I did yesterday.
Really?
The Grand High Lord Mastral and respected Taisha, Lord Praxton, that is my father, is very concerned with Image. The more I protest his decisions, the more he's going to resist giving me what I want. If he were to grant me Mastralship now, it would mean admitting defeat in front of the entire Diem.
But
I don't know why I keep trying. I'm not even convinced that I deserve to be a Mastral. Maybe an Undermastral or a Lestral. Probably even be happy as a Fen, except...
Except?
Except I just can't force myself to let my father win. I guess I'm too much like him.
You should rest now, Acolyte. Be assured we will wake you in time for the ceremonies.
That's good. Then, I think I will.
Kenton lay back on the cot. He did not, however, let them place a damp cloth on his forehead again. Instead, he let himself drift to sleep in the comforting warmth of daylight. It was nearing 10th hour when Kenton was awakened, leaving him enough time to prepare for the ceremony. The ceremonies were always held in the same place, a flat plain of sand. There were cliffs visible in the distance that surrounded the wide plain like the lip of a crater. The white-robed Sandmasters milled together, for the most part remaining self-segregated by the colors of their sashes, which reflected their ranks. The gold Mastrals were at the front, with a group of yellow Undermastrals to the side. Lestrals in black, Underlestrals in gray. The Emfens in brown, Fens in tan, and Underfens in cream. And of course, the Acolytes, who stood in smaller groups, staying with those from their same year. There were about 2,000 of them altogether. Kenton paced through the waiting crowds with Diran, who was excited to share the rumors he had heard.
Is it true what they say about Dryal? Diran, I've already told you that I don't know.
They say Dryal was caught making plans to sell his powers. They say he was gathering a group of Sandmasters to hire out as mercenaries.
I wouldn't doubt it.
It was rare enough for a group of students to produce one Mastral, but Kenton's had produced two. Dryal was even more powerful than Traben. In fact, there were those who whispered he was stronger than Praxton himself. And the worst thing was, Dryal knew exactly how good he was.
Do you think they'll kick him out of the DM?
Maybe. It's happened before.
Not in centuries, though. We never did one so powerful.
Then it will be up to the Lord Mastral, won't it?
I suppose so.
Now, go join your class, Diran.
Yes, Kenton. Tredka, good luck.
Kenton approached the back of the crowd, while Diran drifted off to join the other acolytes. Of them all, only Kenton had no place. Every member of his acolyte group had been advanced 4 years previously, leaving Kenton to attend increasingly redundant classes with acolytes who seemed to get younger every year. He got numerous looks as he walked amongst them, most encouraging, but none accepting. Kenton was alone in the DM. He knew some of the others, especially the lower ranks, respected him. He also knew that many Sandmasters, regardless of rank, disliked him. Even as he passed a group of acolytes, he heard muffled snickers and comments.
It's Kenton. Still? When isn't it?
The students generally mocked their odd, overaged companion. Young as they were, they hadn't yet been forced to deal with advancements and the limit on their potential it would proclaim. This day, however, more of the faces seemed camaraderous than normal.
Traitka, Kenton.
Thank you for your support.
The fair-haired Acolant was not the only one to bid him Traitka, a Kirstian word to confer good fortune. Kenton walked through them, smiling at those he knew, quietly impressed by the level of support he felt. Kenton's optimism faded as he worked his way through a group of Lestrels to stand at the front of the crowd. Lord Mastral Praxton, his eyes hard enough to subdue even the wind, sat surrounded by a half-circle of Mastrals. His chair was crafted completely of wood and was really more like a throne, though kings hadn't been seen in Lossand since the beginning of the Taishan era several centuries before. Praxton huddled in the massive chair like a sandling, watching and waiting with infinite patience. His face displayed as much emotion as a chitinous shell. Kenton walked to the side of the crowd, standing off by himself. Despite their overtures of friendship, none of the Sandmasters invited him to join them. In many ways, the lower ranks were just as exclusive as the higher ones. Perhaps Iloran or Traben would have done otherwise, but they were required to stand with the Lord Mastral. The Undermastrals were already taking their places, forming a larger semicircle behind the Mastrals. The rest of the groups began to quiet, standing in their separate ranks as they waited for the ceremony to begin.
Where are the other Mastrals? I only count 17.
Dryl's missing.
Kenton had noticed, too. Despite what he had told Dirin, he hadn't really believed Dryl capable of something so revolting. Sandmasters were one cohesive whole, regulated by the DM. If smaller groups began selling their services like common tradesmen, chaos would soon be the result.
Look! There! Dryl made it after all!
But he doesn't look happy.
Kenton turned at the talk. A pair of Mastrals were leading Dryl through the group. Dryl was tall and lean, exuding everything that a Sandmaster was supposed to be, powerful, controlling, and arrogant. He walked indifferently through the ranks, as if he were striding before a group of subjects, not being taken under guard to his own trial. At the front of the crowd, he paused briefly, turning eyes on the gathered Sandmasters. The Mastrals behind him froze, uncertain what to do. Dryl was more powerful than any other living Sandmaster, save maybe for Praxton himself. If Dryl decided to run, then the struggle to restrain him could potentially turn dangerous. Fortunately, Kenton was certain there was one law even Dryl would not break. No Sandmaster was allowed to use his skills to hurt another of their kind. It was an injunction as old as the Sands themselves. Dryl regarded the DM for a moment, still smiling. You created me, his look seemed to say. The DM, its arrogance, its remoteness, and its wastefulness, is what had led Dryl to become what he was. Once, the DM had helped everyone, working hand in glove with the citizens of Lossand to enrich their lives, with grand construction projects and a fearsome army that had helped civilize this portion of the planet Taldane. But that was generations ago, and many saw the city of Khazar crumbling, while the Sandmasters did nothing, the very structures their powers had built now succumbing to entropy, their defense now a threat kept in check by bribes and tributes.
Dryl, what have you done?
Dryl turned slowly, arrogantly, to face his accuser, but said nothing.
To make it necessary to engage guards to bring you here. Take your place, Dryl. You're still a Mastral.
As you instruct, Lord Praxton.
Dryl complied with a curt bow, walking over to stand at the head of the Mastrals.
Now, let the ceremony begin. Mastral Iloran, prepare the bowl.
Yes, Lord Mastral.
The Undermastral, foremost of his rank, bowed as he replied. He knelt and freed his guideau from his belt, pouring its contents into an earthen bowl.
My lord.
He handed the bowl to Praxton, who drank a sip and handed it back. Iloran accepted the bowl, then stood uncertainly for a moment, his eyes apprehensive for some reason. Then, apparently deciding that tradition held, even in the face of irregularity, he carried the bowl over and handed it to Dryl.
Now,
Dryal took the bowl, held it for just a second, his eyes meeting those of Praxton. Then, without taking a drink, he handed it to the Sandmaster beside him.
Thank you.
Kalmir accepted the bowl hesitantly, but eventually regained his poise and took a sip, before handing it to the next in line. The bowl moved through the Mastrals, then back to the Undermastrals, before Eloran accepted it once more and carried it back to Praxton.
As we share in one drink, so we are one body united.
Though we are many, we are one body, for we share this one bowl.
With one final sip, Praxton officially initiated the advancement ceremonies. Eloran refilled the bowl before handing it to the first line of watching Sandmasters. They began to drink, each one taking a sip and handing it to his neighbor, refilling it from their gidoine when necessary. The ceremony, however, didn't need to wait for everyone to drink. As soon as Eloran had given away the bowl, Praxton gave him the ceremonial instruction.
Undermastral, show to all the colors that are as old as the sands themselves.
Eloran picked up a sack from beside Praxton's chair and removed several colored sashes from within. Kenton squinted, counting. There were seven, none of them gold. There would be no new Mastrals this day. Eloran accepted a thin scroll from the Lord Mastral and took a few steps forward. He unrolled the scroll.
We gather this day to acknowledge the success of our own, and to award new ranks to those among us who have earned advancement. Step forward, Rindel, son of craftsman Keshtel.
A white-sashed youth stepped forward from the back of the crowd, approaching Praxton's chair on nervous legs.
You have been offered the rank of Under Lestro. Take the sash and be advanced.
Rindel reached forward a trembling hand and accepted the gray sash from the Lord Mastral.
Congratulations.
Thank you, Lord Mastral.
Eloran proceeded, reading the names of Rindel's acolyte group.
Carol.
Each acolyte stepped forward as his or her name was called, accepting a different sash from Praxton. Only one placed higher than the first, a reedy girl who was given the black of a Lestral. It was an average group. Undermastrals and Mastrals were rare. Kenton took a sip from the bowl as it reached him.
You okay, Kenton?
Yes, but whoever refilled the bowl last wasn't carrying very good water.
Finally, only one sash remained in Praxton's hand, a brown one, the rank of DM-fen. It was about midway through the DM's hierarchy, with three ranks below it and four above. Kenton suspected that the sash was meant for him. There had only been six acolytes in this year's group. A DM-fen was no Mastral, but it was higher than Kenton had ever realistically thought he would be offered. Despite himself, Kenton found his mood begin to brighten. Maybe he was giving up, settling for less than he deserved. But the logical, realistic side of him realized that he had made his statement and had succeeded. There would be no more to be gained from pointless resistance. Kenton braced himself as Eloran called his name, except...
Step forward, Dryal, Mastral of the Diem.
What? Dryal?
Dryal stepped out of line. His eyes were calm. He had been expecting this.
Dryal, you have been offered the rank of... DM-fen. Take the sash and be unadvanced.
Unadvanced? Can they...
Lord Praxton knew the rumors, but I didn't expect...
Never in all the history of the DM had a Sandmaster been unadvanced. It was unheard of. Dryal looked down at the sash in Praxton's hand with stunned eyes. Then he stepped close, speaking words only Praxton could hear.
What is this? You seek to insult me, Lord Mastral.
I don't trust you, Dryal. If I expelled you for what you tried, I doubt that you would obey the law and refrain from using your powers. This way, I can still keep an eye on you. You will accept the rank, DM-fen Dryal.
Yes, Lord Praxton.
With a limp hand, Dryal took the sash from Praxton's outstretched hand. As the former Mastral stood looking at the sign of his defeat, Praxton reached out, whipping the gold Mastral sash off Dryal's waist and dropping it to the ground. This was what made Kenton's father a leader, his sheer willpower, the one thing which Kenton had inherited from him. Kenton could only grimace at the irony. What his father would have wanted him to inherit was his sand powers, not this.
Go join your rank, Diem Fang.
Head bowed, Dryl turned, shuffling across the sand in a stunned daze, as if unable to believe what he had just done.
But if the brown sash was for Dryl, then what about Kenton?
They're saying he completed the Mastral's path.
Kenton ignored the whispers, watched, and saw his father retrieve something from the pouch at his side. A cream-colored sash. It meant nothing, no advancement, lower even than the fen he had been offered yesterday. Just an accolant in the DM. Kenton could feel the disappointment and anger rising in his breast as Eloran spoke again.
Kenton, son of Praxton, step forward.
Kenton stepped forward, trying to control his emotions. For some reason, this blow took him harder than any before. He had been ready to give in, prepared to accept the compromise of Diem Fen. He approached the Lord Mastral's seat with a slow step, resting a comforting hand on Iloran's shoulder as he passed.
I told you yesterday I would offer you Fen if you agreed not to run the path. Did you think I would reward you for disobeying me? For slaying the Marken? For ruining the path? You don't even deserve this. But I offer it to you this one last time. Now accept your place as Underfen and be grateful I do not drum you out of the Diem for making a mockery of this ceremony. You don't even deserve this much, Kenton.
Praxton thrust the sash toward him. The words were true, Kenton realized. He had never belonged in the Diem. He had forced them to accept him when they didn't want to, had demanded that they give him attention he didn't deserve, and cried injustice when he was offered the ranks he had earned. He was tired of fighting it. And yet, when he looked into his father's intolerant eyes, the eyes of a man who had lived apart from his family, like all Sandmasters, a man Kenton had never known, Kenton felt that old determination well within him once again.
No. No, I won't be beaten down, Father. I've proven myself worthy of more.
You are certain?
I won the Mastral's path. I beat it.
Then I have no other choice left. Kenton, son of Praxton, I grant you the rank of Mastral.
Kenton froze, stupefied. The Lord Mastral nodded down to the sand at the base of his chair, where a fluttering piece of gold was half buried in the wind-blown sand. Dryl's sash.
Take it.
But I thought, why would you advance me after everything you just said?
Praxton leaned close and spoke low as Kenton took the gold sash.
Have you learned nothing of the Diem during your years here, boy? Yes, they supported you when you were the victim, but that was when they thought you were below them. No one ever thought you would actually succeed.
Kenton turned, shielding his eyes from the mass of animosity behind him. His shocked eyes fell back on his father, who was shaking his aged brow in sorrow.
You think I hated you, boy? I was trying to protect you. Right now, every single one of them is thinking to himself, why was Kenton made a Mastral when I was not? And they are all coming to the same conclusion.
Because I'm your son.
Yes. You will find no peace in this rank, child. Only hatred. The Mastrals will think you unworthy of them. The lower ranks will be envious of your favored position. You could have had purpose and fellowship in one of the lower ranks. You, more than anyone else, should have known how pointless a title is. What would it have mattered if people called you Underfen instead of Mastral? Would that have altered your power, made you any less capable?
No.
Despite all of his accusations, his appeals for reform, Kenton had caught the same disease as every other Sandmaster.
You wanted it, boy. Well, you can have it. Learn what happens to those who define...
Kenton looked up, his eyes seeking for some sort of sympathy from his father. Praxton stared back flatly, his eyes dull, almost like they weren't looking at him at all.
Lord Praxton, Father, what is...
Only then did Kenton notice the arrow sticking out of his father's side.
No! No!
Kenton spun in concern. Tan-clothed forms poured over the short cliffs from behind the Sandmasters, They must have snuck up through the camp. Arrows were falling from bowmen in the back ranks. The crowd of Sandmasters, confused and frightened, stood in mass as the arrows descended on them.
Kertzians!
Run to attack!
As the Mastrels shouted their warnings, they were already calling Sand to life.
Aisha!
Kenton dropped to the ground and grabbed a handful of sand. He rolled to his feet, whipping his sword out with the other hand. All around him, Sandmasters were mastering sand, dashing about in a chaotic mixture of bodies and glowing sand. Some darted into the air, though where they were jumping, Kenton didn't know. Others called up massive walls in front of themselves to block the arrows. Still other Sandmasters didn't seem to know what to do, standing uncertainly with ribbons of sand hovering around them.
But it doesn't make any sense.
Losand hadn't had a war with the Kersdians for centuries, Kenton recalled. True, they hated the DM, but they were also supposed to fear Sandmastery to the point of irrationality. What could have convinced them to attack such a large group? Basically, all the active Sandmasters apart from those on assignment. Kenton pushed speculation aside, dashing forward. Regardless of their motives, the Kersdians were doing surprisingly well in the battle. Sandmastery was the most dangerous weapon on the sands, but its practitioners hadn't needed to defend themselves in hundreds of years. The Sandmasters fought as individuals, sending their ribbons against random Kersdians. The olive-skinned warriors were taking heavy losses, but they were advancing as their superior numbers allowed them to take down the Sandmasters one at a time. Unfortunately, most of the Sandmasters had decided to call up walls of sand to protect themselves, a method that was preventing them from seeing their enemies. The Kersdians easily ducked around the sides of the sand walls, attacking the unprepared Sandmasters with their bolts.
Get out of the way! Get out of—
Ah, you heretic!
Those who were powerful enough had made rings of sand around themselves instead.
Behind me! Behind me!
But that left them totally cut off from the battle, leaving the less powerful to fend for themselves.
Aisha, it's a bloodbath!
Kenton ran into the affray, whipping his sand to life. A Kersdian took sight of him, raising the tube-like Zinkal, a wrist-mounted crossbow, on his arm.
Die, you heretic!
With a flick of his wrist, the warrior released the Zinkal's air pressure, launching an arrow at Kenton's heart. Kenton waved his hand, and his sand obeyed, slapping the arrow out of the air. Then he snapped his finger forward with a sharp motion, drilling the ribbon of sand directly through the Kersdian's forehead.
You're forgetting that sand mastery is the most dangerous weapon on the sand, friend.
The sand fell dead a moment after it touched blood, but a moment was all that was necessary. Another Kersdian was on him a moment later, wielding a spear whose tip was fashioned from sandling carapace.
You're all out of sand, boy.
Kenton brushed the attack aside with his sword.
And you're all out of time.
Kenton drove his sword point first through the Kersdian warrior's breast before the warrior even realized what was occurring, that this Sandmaster had more than one weapon at his disposal. Kenton paused, realizing that something was wrong with the warriors. The one he had just killed, and the attackers all around him, every warrior's forehead bore an X-shaped scar.
That's not right.
Some Kersdians did wear ritual scars on their foreheads, but not all. So this meant something. But before he could consider the matter, he spotted a group of Sandmasters in trouble close by.
No! Not like that!
Kenton hurried toward the group, black-sashed Lestrels who were trying to defend themselves with walls of sand. Kenton reached forward, causing his sand to grab an arrow out of the air just before it hit one of the Lestrels in the chest. The young man, barely 16 years old, looked down at the bolt with a pale face.
What do we do? Use ribbons, not walls! Don't leave yourself vulnerable!
I couldn't catch one like that!
Not even if your life depended on it? You two, watch the Kersdians aiming at us and throw up a wall in front of them, not us. You others, attack! Understand?
Yes, Kenton!
The four Lestrels, three of them were far older than Kenton, agreed, obeying without question, fear in their eyes. There were so many wounded around them already, so many dead. It seemed an impossible task to turn the tide against their attackers now. And yet...
We are Sandmasters! Never forget that! Now, with me! Go!
Kirstians began to fall as Kenton gathered other Sandmasters, adding them to the four Lestrals and creating a ring of organized Sandmasters.
You! Can you stand?
Yes! Ursalato!
Back them up! Find others!
Yes, sir!
As he worked, amassing a creditable defense, Kenton thought on the impossibility of what was happening. The Sandmasters were out of combat practice, true, but even surprised, even unorganized, they should easily have defeated these foes. Something was wrong. Kenton scanned the battlefield, which was scattered with bodies, blood, and blackened sand. All of the rings of protective sand had fallen, crumbling to black dust, and the Sandmasters in sight, especially the Mastrals and Undermastrals, seemed to be in pain for some reason, even the ones who were unharmed. Then Kenton realized what it was.
No!
His throat was sharply dry, his breath starting to come painfully. He was running out of water.
But I've only been mastering for a few minutes!
It did not make sense. He could go a half hour without a drink, longer if he didn't do anything strenuous. Even on the Mastral's path, he may have collapsed at the end, but he had gone a full hour, 100 minutes, without water from his guido. He couldn't argue with his body, however. It was warning him that he had wasted too much water. A short distance away, he saw Traben holding his face in agony.
It hurts! It hurts!
Traben! Traben!
Kenton hurried to his friend's side. Traben stumbled as Kenton arrived, looking up as he dropped to the sand.
No!
Kenton froze in horror. Overmastery had been reached. Dehydration had set in across Traben's body, forcing him to drop to the sand.
Traben, listen to me! Listen to me! Something is happening here! Something!
I can't see!
Traben's face stared back at Kenton with sightless sockets, where he had sucked the water from his own eyes. Even the newest Sandmaster knew how to control himself well enough not to do such a thing.
No!
I can't feel.
As Kenton reached for his friend, Traben's skin flaked beneath his hands, cracking and splitting. It was impossible, Kenton told himself, clutching his friend's body. This was more than just overmastery. It was insanity. No Sandmaster would go this far without relaxing. They would surely surrender first. But no one was surrendering. Around Kenton, Sandmasters were dropping from sheer exhaustion, their bodies turning to dried husks, skin flaking away on the wind. Traben's mouth moved as he tried to speak again, but his tongue was a limp, dried strip in his mouth.
It's okay. Hang on. I have water.
Kenton quickly pulled out his guido, pouring its contents into the fallen Mastral's mouth. Then, uncertain what else to do, he pulled Traben back to the ring of Sandmasters he had formed, setting the wounded man in their center. Like Traben, they too were at risk of overmastering, drying out just as he was.
Wait here. Master as little as possible to defend yourselves. I'll return with water.
Yes, Kenton. Hurry. Please hurry.
The others nodded, eyes wide with panic. He had run the Mastral's path. They wanted him, needed him, to be a hero. Kenton raced through the line of men, attacking a Kirstian with his sword, his movements desperate. Realistically, he knew their chances were slim.
Back off!
Foolish right, Kensha!
He couldn't see a single Mastral or Undermastral still standing. In fact, a good half of the white-robed forms on the plain were immobile. Still, he fought, slaying the Kirstian with an angry command.
Keep back! Keep back!
Kenton whipped his sand forward, slicing it through the chests of three archers in a row before letting it die, lest it drain him of water. Even as he did so, three more Kirstians moved in to surround him, their short-hafted spears long enough to keep him from getting close enough to strike with his sword.
Get him! Hold him! Come on, then! Come on!
Kenton appeared to reach for another handful of sand when he heard Lord Praxton's bellow of rage. Praxton's scream surged across the plain, drawing the attention of both Sandmaster and Kirstian. Back where the battle had begun, beside the fallen throne, stood the Lord Mastral's form, an arrow sticking from his side above his golden sash. Not dead after all. Not yet. The ancient Mastral's eyes were wild with anger as he roared, raising his hands above his head. The sand at his feet rumbled, then exploded with light, shining like a second skin. A column of sand, fully 30 feet in diameter, rose up around him, swirling, pulsing like one of the horrible storms that sometimes struck the coast. The column shot outward, thinning into a wide disk, spreading like a ripple on a pond. The charged sand slammed into Kirstians, spraying gore as it sliced them in half. It moved blindingly quick, shearing bodies, hitting most of them before they realized they were in danger. It split where it encountered white robes, however, leaving Sandmasters unharmed. Dozens of Kirstians fell to the ground before the wave of sand. Ribbons of sand danced and twisted around Praxton as he continued to unleash the deadly wave, like some vengeful god so disappointed in all that he saw that he had no recourse but to wipe the slate clean, ready to start afresh. There was an edge to his screams now, an edge of pain. The Kirstians around Kenton dashed away as the wave approached.
Look out! Run! Run!
For a moment, just a single moment, Kenton wondered if his father's outburst had been only to protect him. And then it faltered, its glow dimming. 100 Kirstian warriors were reloading their Zinkal weapons, peppering the old Lord Mastral's body with arrow after arrow. And in his last moment, the sand itself seemed almost to sigh as Lord Praxton, its master, its colleague, its friend, finally fell beneath the assault. The sand pulsed one last time and fell to the ground as a wide ring of black. At the very same time, the archers aiming at Kenton released their missiles.
No!
And in that final instant, the last of Praxton's sand enveloped Kenton, blocking the arrows that would have claimed his life, even as the great man breathed his last. The darkness claimed Kenton for the second time that day. And there, in total blackness, Kenton fell unconscious.
Where?
Kenton awoke in an embrace.
Where am I?
It was tight and warm and loving, and it covered every inch of him.
How did I get here?
But there was something else, too. Suffocation. He was being held in the sand, under the sand. He was trapped there.
Move! Come on!
He tried moving it with his sand mastery, but his powers would not respond.
No. Think, Kenton. Think!
Every second was another second without breath, another second without sunlight or movement, another second of death. So he climbed, forcing himself up, pushing against the sand that had buried him. And with a final spasm of strength, head first, Kenton burst into the sunlight. Sand poured from his parched and cracked face, leaving behind confused, delirious eyes.
What? What happened?
Only half conscious, he immediately fell back, slumping against the dune in which half of his body was still buried. As Kenton leaned back, his muddled mind reaching for the bliss of sleep, he felt the burning sun above him and knew somehow that he could not afford to fall unconscious again.
Get up, Kenton. You're alive. Keep moving. Keep moving before the sun gets to you.
He didn't know how long he had spent buried in his tomb of sand, but he would not last much longer with his skin exposed to the sun's fury. Exhausted and severely dehydrated, Kenton slowly pulled his body free from the dune.
Don't stop. Can't stop.
Then he let himself slide down the slope until he came to a stop at the bottom. His knee bumped something soft, a body, only recognizable by the white robe and gray sash. Sandlings, ranging from the size of a fist all the way down to dots smaller than a fingernail, feasted on the corpse, chewing away layers of skin as the sun obligingly sucked away the body's deadly water. Most of the corpse had already been reduced to bone.
Aisha, get off him. Get off!
Kenton brushed at the creatures, but as he did, he saw the other bodies, hundreds of them, perhaps thousands, all dressed in the familiar robes of the Sandmasters, and all dead.
Am I the only one who survived? Hello?